Welcome to Jurisdiction, the International Intellectual Property Law Podcast for March 2012. I'm your host, Don Cameron, of Bruskin & Parr LLP in Toronto, Canada. We hope you'll find this podcast informative, but it should not be taken as legal advice. The opinions expressed are solely those of the participants. My guest for this podcast is Robert Fisher. Robert is a partner at Fitzpatrick, Chella, Harper & Cinto in New York City, and is chairman of the firm's Licensing and Transaction Practice Group. Robert has a great deal of experience in litigating patents in a wide variety of technologies. He has a special interest in the area of patentable subject matter and recently participated in an AIPLA webinar entitled Section 101 Gatekeepers, Finding the Patentable Subject Matter Line in a Judicial Sandstorm. Robert's talk focused in particular on the patentability of computer-related inventions and business methods. I spoke with Robert from his office in New York City.
Hello, Robert.
Hi, Don. How are you?
Fine, thanks. Robert, in your paper and your webinar, you reflected on where we are in terms of patentability of business methods and computer software inventions. If I understand your thesis, a lot of where we are depends upon where we came from. And you mentioned three waves of cases, the pre-personal computers, the advent of the internet, and Bilski. Could you take us through those three waves?
Yes, and you are absolutely correct. I think that to understand the case law, one has to see the historical context in which they came from. There are three, I perceive, three sort of sets of cases that roughly correlate like this. The first are the trilogy of Supreme Court cases that really mark the time period prior to the permeation of digital technology into day-to-day life. Those three Supreme Court cases are Gottschalk v. Benson in 1972, Parker v. Fluke, which is 1978, and of course Diamond v. Deere, which is 1981. Then first slowly and then even more rapidly through the 80s and then the 90s, things started to change. People started to get personal computers on their desks. They started hooking up to other data sources with modems and then ultimately the internet. And then internet commerce in 1990 started to take hold. And it was about that time when people started to seriously look at business method patents. And so in 1998, you have your second case, or second major landmark decision, which is the Federal Circuit case of State Street Bank and Trust versus Signature Financial. Marking that as the second time, we now move forward and to where we are today, where internet commerce is no longer a novel thing. It permeates life. And in addition, what we are now seeing are just the beginnings of moving the digital world from our desktop to our mobile devices, whether it's a cell phone or some kind of a tablet kind of device, so that basically you're always connected. And it's in that context that the two Bilski decisions, Bilski versus Kapos in 2008 and 2010, took place. And I think one can recognize in each of these cases how the standards that the courts are applying evolve. And the reason they're evolving is, of course, because now the courts, who are composed of people like anyone else, can perceive what is happening, where before it's more of an abstract intellectual exercise. And now when everyone's living with the technology, you say, hey, now I have to reconsider what my tests are in light of what the world really looks like.
So what were the fundamental principles that came out of the first set, the Benson, Fluke, and Deere cases?
Well, both Gottschalk v. Benson and Parker v. Fluke were, I would say, narrowly circumscribing the ability to obtain, which at that time was software patents, under the existing United States patent statute, basically construing 35 U.S.C. 101 as not being very receptive or accommodating to the idea of having software cover, patents protection cover software. And I think one also must recognize that in order to get to that place and say, well, these inventions are not patentable, the courts would often say, well, what's really the invention here? You know, you'd have six or seven steps or six or seven components in the claim, and they'd look at what is really the inventive step here, and they say, well, really, it's just the software. And then they'd isolate that and say, well, that's just an algorithm, so we're not going to permit patent protection on that. That was a way that claims were analyzed at the time. Later on, and you see this in the Freeman-Walter Abelli trilogy of cases that were enunciated by the CCPA, at least the CCPA said, you shouldn't be doing that. And I believe personally that once people stopped looking for what the heart of the invention is, it made it very, very difficult, more, much more difficult, not to find the claim to pass muster under 35 U.S.C. 101. And let me get back to the cases that I was talking about. Diamond versus Deere was really the first Supreme Court case that permitted patent protection for a software-related invention. And once that happened, we saw a 10-15-year period when that particular case and the Freeman and Walter and Abelli trilogy of cases from the CCPA became the standards for assessing patentability of software-related inventions, which, as you know, directly correlate with business method inventions.
And the Freeman-Walter Abelli test, what was it?
It was basically a two-part kind of an analysis. One, the courts would examine whether the claim was directed to a mathematical algorithm or recited a mathematical algorithm. And if that were the case, that wasn't the end of the inquiry, because the next step would be, well, is the claim itself only directed to a mathematical algorithm, in which case it would not pass muster, or was it applied in any manner to physical elements or a process step, or to process steps, in which case the claim would be found patentable under 101. And again, for the CCPA courts to do that, they're basically saying, look, we can't look at the heart of the invention. We've got to look at the claim as a whole. And that kind of language, in fact, is in the CCPA cases. And it marks, to me, a significant change in direction.
And as you said, the State Street case really changed everything, or at least gave a new flavor. What was the basic principle behind the State Street decision?
Yeah, that's right, Don. The State Street case was really one of the first, I'll put it that way, appellate cases dealing with a pure business method. It was a system for managing mutual funds. And what the case did is, aside from passing on a number of the patentability of the claims at issue there, per se, or specifically, but the court considered and rejected whether, in fact, there was some business method exception to patentability. And the court looked at the historical cases and said, no, that's not really what's going on historically. There really isn't any business method exceptions. The principle precedent that people rely upon for saying that there is a business method exception, in fact, we're really dealing with the issues of novelty and lack of invention, and that we here in the Federal Circuit are not going to endorse any carve-out for business method patents. And so that was a significant advance. And two other things. One, the test itself under State Street was said to be, business method patents are patentable if they are useful, if they are concrete, and they create a tangible result, a very broad test.
And that, as we all know, I think opened the floodgates at the patent office in terms of applications for patenting business methods. Bilski in 2008 and 2010 was another sea change, and that was really focusing on the patentability of methods. Is that right?
Bilski was a case, again, it was a pure business method. It was a method for hedging, avoiding investment losses. And there the claims, which were methods, as you say, were held to be patent ineligible by the Federal Circuit. If I can go on, though, what was interesting about Bilski is it's 10 years after State Street. And interestingly, the Federal Circuit says, well, remember the test I talked about in State Street? That's not the test anymore. I'm going to give another test. And it became what was called the Machinor Transformation Test, which is that in the case of a process, the process either had to be tied to a particular machine or apparatus, or to transform a particular article into a different thing or state. And that was 2008. The case was en banc. And they were basically saying that the prior State Street useful, concrete, tangible test was inadequate.
And the Supreme Court said otherwise, right?
Yes, they did. The Supreme Court affirmed the narrow holding in Bilski that the claims at issue were unpatentable, but nonetheless they rejected the machine or transformation test as the exclusive test for weighing patentability into 35 U.S.C. 101. I might add that this really is not should not come as that much of a surprise. The Supreme Court generally does not like, in my personal opinion, rigid bright line tests. And there has been some criticism of why isn't there a rigid bright line test to give people certainty? And it's a valid criticism. But the difficulty is that the Supreme Court, like any other court, is limited in what it can do by the statute it has in front of it. And from the, I think, given the patent statute and the way it reads, the Supreme Court, if I can read between the lines correctly, feels constrained or somewhat reluctant to impose bright line tests. And this is one instance in Bilski.
Yeah, I think on more than one occasion it seems the U.S. Supreme Court is saying the general rule is there is no general rule. And striking down the CFC's attempts at creating general rules or formulae that might be applied to either patentability analysis or likewise, I'm thinking in the obviousness circumstance of the KSR case, they did likewise and said that the rule the CFC had applied was too restrictive.
That's absolutely right.
Coming back to the Supreme Court case, although they said the machine and transformation test is not the only test for determining patentability of methods, they didn't tell you what else you could use.
That's correct. Just to amplify a little bit about what we were talking about, they don't like bright line tests. They didn't give a bright line test. They didn't, for example, say, well, do this or do that. They did give some guidance to the Federal Circuit. They said, well, you know, it's not the exclusive test, but it certainly is one that is useful. They didn't have anything negative, sweepingly negative to say about business method patents. They didn't say they weren't ever going to be patentable. But again, they didn't even give a definition of what a business method patent was. So for one looking to the case law, the only takeaway you really got from the Supreme Court's decision in Bilski is that one should focus on whether the claim method is directed to an abstract idea or a mental process. And those concepts themselves clearly are not susceptible to bright line definition.
The U.S. Patent Office, as you explained in your webinar, has strived to create some guidelines for practitioners to help them in applying for business method patents and software-related inventions. What's your opinion of those guidelines?
I think that they are quite valuable for anyone trying to get a feeling for what will pass muster in the patent office. One thing I will emphasize to people, it's very good, and you must read cases, but at the same time, the patent office has a process for examining patents, and they are, I think, we can all concede that while the examining corps may be extremely skilled, they're not necessarily one of ordinary skill in the art. And so the standards under 103.1, in order to administer the patent granting process coherently, one must utilize surrogates for the ultimate gestalt test of, is it obvious to one of ordinary skill in the art? The guidelines that the Patent Office has promulgated, particularly in their memorandum dated July 27, 2010, are actually quite helpful because they give you a sense of what the examiners are looking for. If I can give you an example, there's a number of factors in the interim guidelines that the Patent Office will consider or the examiner should consider in weighing toward patentability and some against patentability. For example, weighing toward patentability. Are the claimed steps implemented by a machine? Is the article being transformed an object or a substance? Is the performance of the steps in the claim observable and verifiable? See, those are things that a practitioner can take away and say, now let me look at this claim and where does it stand relative to those factors? For the factors weighing against patent eligibility, is the involvement of the machine merely nominal? Is the machine generically recited that it and such that the claim covers any machine capable of performing the claim steps? Is the transformation that is being cited as being the substantive key to patentability, does it involve really only a change in a position or a location of an article? You know, one can quibble or argue with whether these are the correct factors, but the fact is, at least now, if you want to know what to do, they're good things to look at.
And something you can point to, I presume, in arguments with the patent office and saying, I've made it like this, so please allow my claim in this form.
That's absolutely right.
You also reviewed five recent cases that you indicate provide some further understanding of how the court is now applying Bilski. I wonder if we could take a quick run through those. The first was the CyberSource and Retail Decisions case.
That's right. That particular case was directed to online credit card fraud detection. The case affirmed the summary judgment of invalidity of the two claims that were issued. Claims were found unpatentable. Without going through the claims, the machine, or what the court did, is it said, well, you know, I hear from Bilski that the machine or transformation test isn't the exclusive test, but it's still a useful test. It was applied in this case. And the claim, for example, the method claim, which was directed to verifying the validity of a credit card transaction, was found not to require the use of any machine, not to require any substantive transformation of any article. It was mentioned in the claim of the Internet, but the claim wasn't deemed to be sufficiently tied to the Internet. There was also, interestingly, in that case, a claim to a computer-readable medium. That claim itself, you would think, because it's directed to an article per se, might be found patentable. That wasn't the case. In fact, the court said, well, we're going to be looking at what we really have here, and what we really have here is a process or a series of steps. That's what the computer program that's supposedly on the computer-readable medium is. And they said, well, just based upon those steps, we don't see anything patentable here. And again, that harks back to what was done in the earlier cases where you would look for what's really the essence of the invention here. Okay, I found that interesting. After CyberSource, you mentioned Ultramershal. It's a method of delivering over the Internet copyrighted material. That case, which had a different panel than the CyberSource case, they found the claim patentable under 101. I won't go into it. They did not apply the machine or transformation test. It was a much more, if I can say it, it was a very different judicial approach than what we saw in the in the CyberSource case. A lot of promulgation of what I would call judicial management rules, which were very sophisticated, very interesting from a judicial standpoint. I would submit it not of not much help if you're trying to tell the patent examining corps how to examine cases. There was another case after that, DealerTrack versus Uber. Oh, by the way, on the case I just mentioned, the Ultramershal case, I think there's a related case right now before the Supreme Court. At least one of the parties is trying to get certiorari, and that's being briefed even as we speak. I bring up that point because this is a rapidly evolving area, both at the Federal Circuit and at the Supreme Court level.
The Ultramershal case that you mentioned seemed to, as you explained in your paper, emphasize much more the technology that was involved, and it required a website, and it seemed to be much more linked to technology and hardware than did the CyberSource case.
That's correct, and that is one takeaway I should emphasize, that if one were to say, how do I make a claim more palatable, both to a court and to the patent office, the more it reads like there's a lot going on from the in connection with the tangible world, the better off you are.
Something the human mind could not carry out as well.
Exactly, because if one were just to say, what you will see in some of these cases is the courts will say, well, can I perform all these steps in the human mind? And if the answer is yes, they won't find it passes muster under 101.
So I think you were moving on to the DealerTrack case.
Yeah, the DealerTrack case.
Or DealerTrack, rather. Can't read my own handwriting, sorry.
That was a system for filling out forms for applying car loans. There was an intermediary involved, but basically you went to one source, and then it would reformat your car loan application to different financial institutions. And that, too, was found to be not pass muster under 101. It was considered an abstract idea, preemptive of a fundamental concept. The court did a careful, I would say, precedential analysis. They said, look, the claims here look a lot like Bilski. And they distinguished the claims at issue from the Ultramershal case on just the point you mentioned. They said, well, look, if you look at Ultramershal, the claim method was directed to the practical application of concrete steps requiring an extensive computer interface. And so they said, well, this case isn't like that. And the claims were found unpatentable. There was an even a more recent decision on February 27th, Ford Properties. Okay, the claims there were directed to a method for creating a tax-deferred real estate investment trust. Claims, again, were found unpatentable under 101. So that takes us up pretty much into the present.
So what seems to be looming large in a lot of these cases, thanks to Bilski, is the is it abstract? Is it too abstract? Is it not abstract? From a Canadian, I think a European perspective, that's seen as a really tough test to figure out. As you said, there's no real bright line. Do you see any sort of easy solution in the future to that, or are we going to have to slog through case by case before we have a better definition of what is an abstract idea compared to one that is applied or non-abstract?
That is a very difficult question, Don. In my view, we are going to have to slog through case by case. Will the Supreme Court provide further guidance or clarification? If I had to bet, and it would just be a bet, the answer is no. The reason is, had they wanted to do it, they could have done it in Bilski. So what we are going to be left with, and this is, we're all looking at a crystal ball here, who knows, is the Federal Circuit, and depending on who's on the panel, you may get a very different, I'm not saying outcome, but you may get a very different analysis. Because the one thing I have noticed with the Federal Circuit panels is that they tend to take equally principled, but sometimes quite different approaches to analyzing the cases. Are they, for example, precedential-centric versus formulating quite principled administrative rules for determining what to do? And you come out with cases reading quite differently. So I think the short answer to sum it up is we are in for a long set of cases over the next year, 2 years, 5 years, or 10 years until things settle out. And that's assuming, moreover, that the technology stays static. And rest assured, it's not going to.
Thank you very much for these insights, Robert.
My pleasure, Don. And I think this is a field that we'll all have a lot of fun seeing evolve over the next couple of years.
Robert Fisher is a patent lawyer with Fitzpatrick, Chella, Harper, and Cinto in New York City. For further information on Robert Fisher and his paper on patentable subject matter, and for information on our other jurisdiction podcasts, please visit iplawpodcast.com. You have been listening to Jurisdiction, the International Intellectual Property Law Podcast. I'm Don Cameron of Breskin & Parr LLP in Toronto, Canada. Thank you for listening.